Well, as you heard there on the Nuacht, the sad news that the novelist and playwright Jennifer Johnson died in Dunleary yesterday, surrounded by her family. She was 95. Jennifer Johnston published her first novel, The Captains and the Kings, in 1972. The book went on to win the Evening Standard Award for Best Novel. She was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 1977 for her fourth book, Shadows on Our Skin. And in 1979, she won the Whitbread Prize for her novel, The Old Jest. In 1974, 2 years after her first book, Jennifer Johnston published How Many Miles to Babylon? The book about the First World War has become her best-known work, which she herself adapted for the stage, and it features on school curricula. In 2016, Jennifer did an interview with Sean Rocks here on Arena, and they spoke about her writing practice.
You're living in Dunleary now. How vital is the act of writing for you at this point?
Well, it's very, very important to me because it's my life. And I've been doing it for far too many years. And I found with this moving here that I have stopped writing and I can't get into my head. I did have, I thought, a very good notion. And I started writing it. And it all slithered away. And I tried to think back what it was like writing when I started doing it first, because I didn't know anything about it then. I didn't know whether a thing was good or bad when I wrote it down, and I had to sort of stare at it, and I still didn't know. I have learned how to use words better, but I haven't learned, I think, perhaps how to gear up the inside of my head and use the whole thing. I am going to write another book, I know. But I'd better get on with it quickly.
Jennifer Johnston speaking to Sean Rocks in 2016. Well, Jennifer's family background was steeped in theatre. Her father was the playwright Dennis Johnston, and her mother was the actor and producer Sheila Richards. And in her career, she wrote many plays. One person who worked with her on those plays is the theatre director Caroline Fitzgerald, and Caroline joins me now. Caroline, thank you so much for talking to us this evening. And as well as being your collaborator, Jennifer Johnston is also your cousin. So our sympathies to you on the loss of your cousin and your friend.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Yes, it's a loss, as you might. But you know, she will always live in her books. She will always live in her plays, and she's there. She's out there. Yeah. Well, in the ether.
So many writers remembering Jennifer today have talked about the importance of How Many Miles to Babylon to them in their formative years of reading and as writers. You directed the stage adaptation of the work. What was it about that work that was so important to the young reader?
I suppose I don't really know. It caught all of us. It was very odd because we did it first in Belfast in the Lyric. And it was during, I can't remember the date of it. I think it was around about the late 70s or early 80s. And it wasn't a good time. And there were, you know, sometimes you felt you were in the trenches. You'd hear explosions and things going on. So that all went into the atmosphere of the performances. But it was about all these young men, very young men, and rather older men, and the emotion and their danger and relationships with mothers. And it kind of had all the ingredients to get particularly young people interested in it.
Yes, and there was two young men, wasn't there, at the centre?
Yeah,
one from the an upper class family,
yes,
and the other
exactly.
a poor young.
And of
young
course, that was frowned on, but they became the greatest of friends. And then I don't know if you saw it, but the turnaround at the end. I won't give it away. I tell everybody listening, go and read it. It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book.
Now, another thing that people have said today in the tributes to Jennifer Johnston is about her generosity to emerging writers. Why was that so important to her to nurture people?
Well, I think she knew herself how difficult it was, you know, and how difficult it still is to get heard or seen. And she'd been through that of going through the motions of being uncertain about her own gift, and then it came out. And so she was really giving back all of that. And she was by nature a very generous person, a very kind person. So it came naturally to her. And she loved writers, she loved actors, she loved theatre. You know, it was all part of her life.
Now, she published relatively late in life, which came as a surprise to me. She was 42. But she had a remarkable career in that life. Her son, I think Patrick Smith, said the writing was her way of escaping domesticity and isolation. I think when she lived in the north, she felt a little isolated, did she?
Yes, but they were in London as well for a long time. And, you know, when the kids were sort of growing up. And it was really such an open house, but she was so disciplined that, you know, come what may, 9 o'clock, sit down, work for 3 hours every day. And that was key to her doing anything else, if you know what I mean.
Now, Caroline, as well as a friend and, as I said, a cousin, you were also her collaborator. So how did it come about that you directed some of her work?
Well, that came about because I had been a stage manager up till the sort of mid-80s, and I decided really now I wanted to direct. I felt I'd learnt a little bit. And Jennifer had done a couple of short plays. They were in the Peacock in the Abbey, and she showed me one called The Porch, one woman show, or there were three people in it, but it was virtually a one woman show. And she said, "Well, will we do this?" And I said, "Yes, but where will we do it? And who'll do it?" So we got a wonderful actress called Doreen Hepburn, who was from the north, and she loved it. Actors love Jennifer's words. They love performing in her plays because they have such a bedrock of reality about them. And we did it in the Gaiety Theatre in the Dress Circle Bar, and we did very well, and we had good houses for a week. And it just went on from then, and every so often I would get a script and she'd say, "Is this any good?" And I would say, "Oh, yeah. Let's do it." And we did some in the Peacock, and we did some in the Linen Hall Library, and then we did Babylon, and another wonderful play she wrote called Desert Lullaby, which hasn't been seen here. I think it should be.
And she loved the theatre, didn't she? I mean, she came from the theatre world.
Yeah, but she was so uncertain about her playwriting ability. She kept saying, "These aren't really plays, are they?" And I said, "They are plays. They're plays. They're lovely. They're plays. Everybody adores them. And they always do well." And so, yeah, it came about like this. She was so modest about her writing, you know, really, in the sense, especially in plays. And there was one wonderful thing where somebody wrote a very intellectual review about one of them, and explaining the plot and explaining the characters' motives. And Jennifer was reading it. She turned to me and she said, "God, I wish I'd known all that when I was writing it."
Oh, well, thank you so much, Caroline, for taking the time to talk to us on this sad evening.
I'll finish with just two things, if
I
may. One, not known if you knew her well. She was a wonderful cook and very, very hospitable to everybody. And as Frank McGuinness just said to me a while ago, he said she was a lion.
How wonderful. So, a lion. Thank you so much, Caroline Fitzgerald, for talking to me.
Not at all, and thank you.
Her collaborator and her cousin, Caroline Fitzgerald, thank you very much. Remembering novelist Jennifer Johnson, whose death was announced today. David Frost was an English television host, journalist, comedian and writer who rose to prominence in the UK when he hosted the BBC TV series That Was the Week That Was in 1962. His success on that show led to work as a host on many TV shows, including American television. He quickly gained a reputation for his interview style, and particularly with senior political figures. Among them, his interviews with the US President Richard Nixon in 1977, which were later adapted into a stage play and film with Michael Sheen playing David Frost, Frost Nixon. A documentary series streaming on Sky and Now gives audiences a chance to witness Frost's interviews with some of the most iconic figures of the 20th century, from the Beatles to Muhammad Ali. The series was made by his son, Wilfred Frost, a journalist with Sky News, and I'm delighted that Wilf is joining me on the line now. Congratulations on your series.
Okay, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Now, for some of our audiences who might not be so familiar with your father, David Frost's work, can you tell us a little about him and his achievements? He was a very famous man in his day, wasn't he?
Well, he certainly was. And the extraordinary thing, I think, about Dad was both the breadth of his television career, from politicians to sports stars to pop stars, and doing stand-up comedy as well. He wasn't just an interviewer. And I think the length of his career. He broke onto the scenes as a 22-year-old doing That Was the Week That Was, as you mentioned, in the early 1960s. And he was on television until the day he died for Al Jazeera 50 years later, age 74. Quite an extraordinary run in what is a very competitive field, of course.
Do you think it was that beginnings in comedy that made him such a good interviewer? Because he had that ease, and he had the ease in front of the camera and then also with his guests.
I think it was perhaps the second most crucial factor that he had, uniquely that he had. Because as you say, that warmth and wit and comedy made him just a very engaging and entertaining person to be around. I think of time with Dad as happiness. He was just a very infectiously positive person to be around. And I think that certainly helped his interviews, and I think helped him book his guests, actually, because they wanted to spend time with him. But more importantly than that, I think he was just fascinated by people, whether that was famous people, prime ministers and pop stars, or just my friends or people he worked with. He had a genuine curiosity about individuals. And I think that led to fantastic free-flowing conversations.
Yes, and the first episode of the series shows that he was a bit of a grafter. He knew he was good at interviewing people. He knew what he wanted to do. But there's a big jump between wanting to have your own show and getting your own show.
Absolutely. And, you know, he broke onto the scene with this, you know, satire show, a comedy show, which ended up being short-lived when the British government cancelled it. And he wanted to pivot to interviewing, but it was hard initially. And in fact, only because his mate, Paul McCartney, a fellow young 20s, anti-establishment 1960s character as Dad was, granted him an interview at a time when it was absolute gold dust to get an interview with the Beatles. His first studio interview was with Paul McCartney. And I think what's really interesting in the first episode is you see how Dad and the Beatles' career paths kind of rise and fall at different times. By the late 60s and early 70s, Dad has a show in the United States and in the UK. The Beatles are sort of breaking up, and particularly with John and Yoko, who want to talk politics and talk their passions, it's almost, you know, turn tables. Dad's giving them a platform then by that stage. And I think the way the two careers are intertwined between Dad and the Beatles is a fascinating part of episode one. He did 15 interviews with the Beatles.
Yes, he's very clever at the way he sees that the Maharaji and they are interested in transcendental meditation at that stage. So he goes after their guru, and through the guru, he gets to talk to two of the Beatles.
Exactly. And so he's a little bit sneaky on that occasion to lure his mates back on, but for what ended up, by the way, Kay, being two episodes. We don't quite capture that in the first episode of David Frost Versus, because, you know, we're always limited by time and there were so many great interviews to pick from. But that conversation was so deep and so engaging for the audience that they ran out of time, and Dad said at the end, "Will you come back again next week?" And they did. So actually, what we see in the episode was shot over a Friday show and a following Wednesday show, And that was some of the best stuff you get out of John Lennon and George Harrison on that day, because it was teed off by talking about the Maharishi and meditation. They really talk about deep topics, the meaning of life, not just, you know, their latest single.
And now, I love the clip with John and Yoko. They're on with your dad, and he starts by talking. He shows a piece of wood with nails, and this is a piece of conceptual art that Yoko has created. But it elicits a beautiful moment of conversation.
It certainly does, because, you know, what's amazing about that, as you look back on it, is the hammering nails into a piece of wood, which, as you say, is a piece of Yoko's art. It looks a bit ridiculous today. I think it was even more ridiculous back then. But Dad embraced it and didn't mock Yoko. You know, John and Yoko came on three times in short order. Their first public outing together was on Dad's show in London, 1968. Then soon after in New York in 1969 and again in 1972. And I think Dad saw Yoko for who she was herself, but who she was to John. And that bred a trust. It gave Dad those repeated extended interviews and created some, you know, really amazing television moments.
Let's listen to that clip now, which shows your father interacting with Yoko and John.
How could you summarise what you want to get across to our people?
We're not all that articulate, and it's nerve-wracking being on TV and trying to explain yourself. Now, we try and explain ourselves in what we do, like, and I do it mainly through music, and she does it through her art like that. And it's hard to put words to it.
No, we're not trying to explain.
Yeah, but the thing,
we're just
okay.
trying to communicate.
Communicate. You
know? And communication itself is art, and art is communication. And so we don't believe in just making something and completing it and giving it to people, but we like people to participate.
You've got a piece of wood here. Now tell us about the piece of wood and the nail.
This is just a painting that people come and hammer a nail in wherever they want to, and that makes the shape of the painting.
Was banging the nail in that the two of you first found that you agreed on art?
She didn't know who I was and was saying, do you like to hammer a nail in? It's 5 shillings. So I said, I didn't have any money either. So I said, I'll hammer an imaginary nail in. I'll give you an imaginary 5 shilling. And she agreed with that. She accepted that on the same basis as we accept her work. You know? And that was how we met, actually.
That's David Frost there with John and Yoko. Such a charming clip, isn't it?
It really is. It's warmth personified. And again, I think that was key to Dad with lots of his interviews, but particularly with John and Yoko at that time. You know, Yoko was vilified, frankly, and faced a lot of pushback because she was wrongly seen as pulling John away from the Beatles. There was a racist element, I think, in the press as well at the time. But Dad was the opposite towards her, and I think they felt warm and relaxed in Dad's company.
Now, we say episode one was mainly about the Beatles, but all the episodes are putting your star interviewees or your father's star interviewees in the context of the time. And that is very potent when it comes to episode two, which the star of episode two is Muhammad Ali. But what the context is race in America.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, different episodes are slightly more biopic on the individual in the title than others, but they all have a backbone of a theme. And as you say, episode two's theme is civil rights in America in the 60s and 70s through the prism of Dad's 12 interviews with Ali, but also with key civil rights leaders, with some racist politicians like Governor Wallace as well. And I think we do really feel like you're in the moment because of that personal and very deep way in that the Frost-Ali relationship provides.
Now, your father interviews George Wallace. He was a governor at the time, and he was running to be president of America. And he had very strong views on segregation of the races. And your father was trying to pursue him on that. And it was interesting then when it came to the Ali interview that Muhammad Ali had similar views to, albeit coming from a different point of view, with George Wallace. Could you explain that kind of tangle of attitudes to race?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Governor Wallace, as you said, was the perennial governor of Alabama, running for the presidency in 1968, trying to get the Democratic nomination, as it happens, which he didn't get. But then he stood in as independent and still won five states in 1968. Very clearly pro-segregation. And Dad asks him in an interview, you know, would you let your daughter marry someone of a different race? And he says no. And it's quite a powerful moment that Dad's holding him to account on. As you then say, Ali, in their first interview together, 1968, espouses, you know, similarly fierce views. I think it's always important to set the context of the time. And Ali, at that moment, was banned from boxing for refusing the Vietnam draft, and he felt that had been racially motivated, I think, you know, with some legitimacy, which I think gives more context and explanation for his views than Governor Wallace's.
So, Wilf, I think we'll play that clip now, which has Muhammad Ali's response to your father's question.
Would you like to see a day when black and whites got on great?
No, because that'll cause there'll be intermarrying then. We'll mess up our race. Integration means self-destruction.
But, I mean, you sound like Governor Wallace talking.
I'm with Wallace. If I had to vote, which I don't, I'd vote for Wallace, because Wallace tells the truth. He talks like way white people feel. And as a whole, black folks feel like me. See, a strong cup of coffee is black. When you make it weak, you pour white cream in it. You integrate it. You understand?
But it tastes better.
No. The stronger black. You want the rich dirt. You want the black dirt. You want the best sugar. Gives you less calories as the brown sugar. Your greatest world's boxers, football players, rock and roll artists, jazz musicians, basketball players. We are the greatest on the planet. The black people in America are the best on the planet in everything they get a chance at.
Nobody.
I don't want to mix myself
in
up
in this
now.
World of ours today. Nobody can do things on their own. Even your black coffee is composed on the one hand of black grains and on the other hand of uncoloured water.
What wonderful conversations they had. I mean, I can't imagine those kind of conversations going on now on a TV chat show.
No, I mean, it was unbelievable, wasn't it? Completely unfiltered, absolutely live and hugely, hugely provocative. I think what always stands out to me in that is the way in which Dad successfully pushes back, but again, with warmth. There's a sort of wit in there as well that I think means he's not quite slapping his guest around the face to say you're wrong. He's pointing it out in as polite a way as he can. And what's remarkable to me about that interview is that it is combative, and yet it's the first of 12 interviews Dad did with Ali. He managed to convince Ali to come back on within a year. And of course, over the course of the 12 interviews, we see how his views do change and soften and alter. And we get to witness that through this amazing relationship that the two men built on camera and off over 34 years and 12 interviews.
That's right. And also you see Ali's mood changing when he was afraid of being sent to prison for dodging the draft or standing up to the draft. He's a depressed man.
I agree. And what's quite striking is we always think of him now as this hugely confident man full of bravado and boasts and poems. And there is a couple of those interviews, one when he thinks he's never going to fight again, and one when he has been allowed to fight again but lost, and then he thinks he might never regain his title, where he is, as you say, much more reserved, much more introspective. And I think it's pretty striking to see that Ali, as well as, of course, the electrically confident Ali that we witness in some of the other interviews too.
Now, as we said, episode two, even though it's mainly about Muhammad Ali, it talks about race, and he talks to really powerful black contributors like Jesse Owens, for example. And then there's Diane Carroll, mm-hmm. the wonderful singer. And there was a love affair between your father and her.
There was, I mean, more than a love affair. They were engaged. They met on screen, and Dad always, you know, would say he fell in love in that moment. And they were together for 3 years, three very happy years. And obviously, this was a long time before I was around, but Diane was around in our lives, and Mum was very, very fond of her too. She was a wonderful lady. Of course, sadly passed away a few few years ago, and it wasn't to be, but it was a very happy 3 years that Dad had with Diane.
So you don't edit in this show, you show all sides of your dad.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that is absolutely who Dad is and would want. And as a journalist, I think that's absolutely key.
Now, in episode 3, there is it's about revolt and protest, and he goes to Northern Ireland. What were his views on Northern Ireland? We'll hear a clip from that in a moment.
Well, Dad was the ultimate objective interviewer and journalist. You know, I don't think he ever approached any interview with a preconceived idea. I don't think he had an ideological bone in his body. And I think he really tried to bring balance to everything. I mean, the show you're referencing, which came a week after Bloody Sunday, has got to be one of the hardest moments ever in Dad's career to continue to carry that balance into it. And I think he achieved it, but it was incredibly heated at times, but for obvious reasons. And, you know, you asked me the question, what was his view on that topic? I couldn't tell you, because he remained balanced throughout on these things. I mean, I think the only thing I can tell you unequivocally is he believed in right and wrong. He had a very clear moral compass that came from his upbringing as the son of a Methodist minister, and he believed deeply in God. But he wouldn't, you know, pin his colours to the mast of any topic, particularly one as divisive, of course, as hosting a show after Bloody Sunday.
Let's hear that clip now.
Armoured cars. Not in Vietnam or the Middle East, but in the United Kingdom. We found the people of Derry stunned, was the word we kept hearing, stunned by the events of Bloody Sunday. How many people in the audience here have been on the receiving end of violence in the past year?
Yes. Yes. I was arrested by the British Army on no less than 5 occasions, and on 2 of those occasions I was beaten.
Do you think the British troops could be removed tomorrow without immense bloodshed?
It's as simple as this. The struggle, the fighting in Ireland will continue until British imperialism in our country is defeated.
Whoever put that programme on the air had real balls, I think.
There is 2 sorts of violence, isn't there? There is self-defence, there is reaction, but there is also haphazard murder.
We make the television studio a kind of public meeting place, something that's happened that affects the lives of the people in the audience. Magic idea, right?
People are going to have to work it out.
And that's television at its best, I think.
Sorry, could you put your hands up? Yes. Oh, several of you. Yeah. Yes.
Among the voices there, people will have recognised the voice of Eamon McCann. That's from The David Frost Show. Wilf, there are 3 episodes currently available on Sky. So there are 3 more in production or ready to go?
Yeah, well, they were just polishing up the edits, Kay, which is why they're not with you yet. But 3 more to come. So David Frost versus The Beatles, Ali and Fonda are out. And David Frost versus Richard Nixon, Elton John and The Middle East are to come. And just on the topic of that clip you just played, there's a great sequence in the Middle East episode where we pivot from the tragedy of peace not arriving but being so close in the 90s between Israel and Palestine to the joy and euphoria of the Good Friday Agreement. And Dad did an extraordinary interview, a joint interview with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair together, the only time that a sitting president and prime minister have sat down together for an interview. And it's a really wonderful moment in an otherwise, of course, tragic episode, particularly given where we are today with the Israel-Palestine conflict. Do you know what? I've always appreciated the importance of that interview, but it's shot up to the top of my list in the last few months making this episode. And I hope it's a moment that Irish viewers in particular enjoy.
Well, we look forward to the 3 that are currently available and the 3 coming up. Wilf Frost, thank you so much for talking to us. As I said, the first 3 episodes of his docuseries, Frost Versus, are available to stream on Sky and Now TV, with 3 more to follow at a later date.
Okay, thanks so much for having me. A real pleasure.
So welcome. half years have passed since the release in 2021 of the most recent James Bond film, No Time to Die. And obviously, considerably more time has passed since the film itself was actually made, fueling industry speculation that all was not well with Bond. Crucially also, no 007 had been appointed since Daniel Craig left the iconic role. Well, towards the end of last week came the bombshell announcement that Amazon had taken over full creative control of the film franchise from long-standing producers Barbara Broccoli and her half-brother Michael G. Wilson. The Broccoli family have been behind all of the Bond films. Barbara's father, Albert Cubby Broccoli, was the original producer who brought Bond to the screen. Barbara and Michael took over with GoldenEye, and Barbara herself is credited with the inspired casting of Daniel Craig for Casino Royale. The Broccolis were renowned for being famously protective of James Bond, so what will this major creative change mean for the beloved films? I'm joined now by Donald Clark, who's been following the story. Donald, I suppose we should start with what happened after No Time to Die, the last Bond film.
Well, the short answer, Kay, which has been part of the mystery, is nothing. And that was kind of the great mystery, in that there have been periods before when there have been quite long interregnums between James Bond films, most notably between the last Timothy Dalton film and the first Pierce Brosnan film. But it looks like it's going to be whatever happens now, the longest ever since the film series first started in 1962. That film that you mentioned, No Time to Die, was a genuine hit. That's mystery as well. It's not as if people are sitting around, were sitting around thinking, you know, can we make another James Bond film? It made the guts of $750 million. And it was kind of seen as demonstrating that cinema was still alive. Only the Spider-Man film that year made more in 2021. Now, we should say we're going to discuss the end of that film. So if you have not yet got round to No Time to Die after 3.5 years, you'll forgive us. At the end of No Time to Die, Daniel Craig's version of James Bond died. And therefore, it was apparent that any notion of Craig coming back was moot. That was not going to happen. So we're going to have a new James Bond. Everyone was bandying names backwards and forwards. Is Tom Hardy too old? Is Idris Elba too old? Almost certainly yes in both cases. Before Christmas, a story emerged in the Wall Street Journal suggesting that Barbara Broccoli and her half-brother, Michael G. Wilson, who, as we say, has been running E.ON, the company that produces Bond, for 20, 30 years, was at loggerheads with the new owners of the copyright, Amazon, who bought MGM, who are long partners of Bond, a few years back for a vast sum of money, somewhere around of $6.5 billion. But that $6.5 billion did not actually give them creative control of what was happening to each individual Bond film. That remained with E.ON, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson's company. So this Wall Street Journal story was full of quite amusing stuff, of Barbara taking offense that somebody at Amazon had referred to James Bond series as content, that dread word. There was a suggestion that somebody had suggested he wasn't really a hero. And most, we suspect, most damaging of all, we don't really know exactly what happened, but the suspicion has always been since Amazon took over that they were going to try and edge it more in the direction of how modern franchises are currently exploited. You look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there are endless TV series, there are endless spin-off films, the same thing has been happening with Star Wars, whereas Broccoli and that team have essentially, for all this time, produced one film. At one stage, they're producing one film every 18 months or so in the 60s and 70s, less frequently now, but just one film as part of the series. The notion was that was the dispute. We're not entirely sure that's true, but it sounds kind of plausible.
But Donald, doesn't it all come back a little bit to the creative partnership between Barbara Broccoli and Daniel Craig? I mean, even the decision to kill Bond off at the end of No Time to Die, had she thought ahead about what the next film would be? How could they bring him back to life? Who would direct it? Who would write this?
Well, I'm a little puzzled, I've got to be honest, by some of the responses in the media to this notion that it was some kind of problem that they killed off James Bond, a narrative problem. And I can remember walking out of the cinema thinking, oh, yeah, OK, well, it's quite clear what's going to happen now. It's and it's, you know, apt, it's pretty straightforward. There's only one thing that they can do, and they've done it before. They're going to reboot the whole movie, which is what happened to Casino Royale. I mean, what I was thinking when I saw that was, okay, a new convention has been set up here where whenever you change James Bond, you entirely reboot the project. That is to say, everyone else gets sacked, along with every other actor gets sacked, along with Daniel Craig. So, you know, bad news for Naomi Harris, bad news for Ralph Fiennes. You start again with an entirely new cast. You then decide where you're going to put James Bond. Are you going to go right back to the beginning, which is more or less what happened with Casino Royale.
So do you go back to the Ian Fleming books, or do you...
Well, I mean, that's sort of slightly different argument. But, I mean, in terms of the time scale, are you taking James Bond back to the beginning of his career, which has happened with Casino Royale? Remember, from that point on, when he met Blofeld in the series, he hadn't met Blofeld before. He didn't know M. So that was a complete reboot. That seems pretty straightforward to me.
Well, it's going to be a complete reboot. But why didn't she do that? So what's the thinking behind that?
Had she moved quickly, I would have felt, and produced a plausible, reasonably youngish James Bond who could last another 10 or 20 years, 10 or 15 years, let's give it 20, that I think this problem probably wouldn't have arisen if the thing has got going again. But because there was this long pause, it seemed inevitable that some point was going to come to a crisis, and that crisis arrived last week, that Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson essentially said they were no longer exercising creative control over Bond, that had been taken over by Amazon. And we don't know what conversation went on between her and Amazon. But what surprised me most in all this conversation, that having happened and understanding how that could lead to a crisis, is I am still, whatever we hear about money, surprised that this move of creative control from E.ON to Amazon has happened. I've met Barbara a few times. I always found her a very positive and interesting and impressive, intelligent person. And my notion always was, given her loyalty to the project and her loyalty to the family, that you would have needed to prize control of Bond from her cold, dead hands. So I would be interested to hear what else comes out about that particular decision over the next few weeks.
And what would be your hope, if there is any hope, in relation to the Amazon deal and they taking over?
Well, I think... But live in the real world. I mean, my hope would be, I mean, we all know, those of us who follow James Bond down through the years, if we're honest about it, a lot of films were not terribly good. You know, the Roger Moore films were good fun until they were asking a little bit too loudly for you to find them to be good fun, and ended up being a bit silly. The Dalton ones were a bit dull. The Brosnan ones were fine. And they found their footing again with Craig. I mean, I would be conservative enough to suggest that I don't think any kind of radical reinvention is required in the nature of James Bond to keep it healthy. I think, you know, you can have Bond who's a bit younger than Craig when was he started. I certainly think that, you know, some of the names of people of colour we put about would be interesting. But I think the core notion that Broccoli had of having this, you know, slightly brutal imperial thug of a certain age, which is the creation of Ian Fleming 67 years ago, I think continuing with that's a good idea. Now, if we accept the fact that we're living in the real world, I don't think, incidentally, my bet would be that Amazon are not going to go crazy, that they're not going to, you're not going to have a, you know, James Bond cartoon. You're not going to have like a baby James Bond in an animation for children. I think there will be spin-offs, but I don't think they're going to go bananas. I would be of that nature that if we're going to have some kind of radical reinvention, there's a whole strain of Bond fans throughout the world, which I'm one. I'd kind of like to see a period Bond. I mean, I actually mentioned this to Barbara Broccoli at one point, one of the interviews, and she kind of nodded along patiently as if she'd been, saying.
When you say period, what period do you mean?
Late 50s, early 60s. If you go back to the period when the Bond novels were written, not necessarily the original text, because those novels are very strange books in all kinds of ways, and they require a certain degree of reinvention for the modern world in terms of their attitudes towards race and woman, if nothing else. But that would be a very interesting way to go. Now, that would mean you couldn't have quite the levels of technology which has been a characteristic of Bond down through the era. But, you know, that's an idea that's long been run at the flagpole. If we're going to reinvention, I would enjoy that.
Are there directors queuing up that still would like to get their teeth into a Bond film?
Well, Christopher Nolan has been kind of equivocal about this. I mean, I say equivocal in that he has said he'd love to invent do a James Bond film. Then he's kind of hummed and hawed and so forth. So I think if the conditions were right, I think Nolan probably would want to do one. There was that wild notion a decade or two ago when Tarantino put out the idea of his doing one. What I would say is that one thing that Broccoli Wilson did do in the latter half of the Craig era was they made Bond respectable again for posh directors, by which I mean you had Sam Mendes. Yeah, coming in, who was the first, you know, Oscar winner to direct a Bond film. Before that point, they'd been good directors, don't get me wrong, but they tended to be journeyman directors who most of the time were best known for making James Bond films, frankly. But since then, you've had directors who proved their mettle elsewhere coming in, most notably Sam Mendes. So I think, you probably could get hold of a director who has established a career elsewhere. It would have been harder to do, I think, in the 70s and 80s when it wasn't regarded as a wholly respectable job for an upmarket director to take on. But yes, I think you certainly could get interesting directors into the job if you tried hard enough.
Okay, well, hope springs eternal that Amazon will do the right thing. Donald Clark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Museum of the Moon is a luminous artwork which is 7 metres in diameter and features detailed NASA imagery of the lunar surface. It has been exhibited in more than 300 venues in 40 countries, and next month Museum of the Moon arrives in Kilkenny, where it will be suspended from the ceiling of St. Canice's Cathedral for 3 weeks. The artwork was created by Luke Jerram, a British artist who has been creating sculptures and large art installations in the UK and internationally since 1997. I'm delighted to be joined on the line now by Luke Jerram. Luke, what can visitors to St. Canice's expect to experience with Museum of the Moon?
It's lovely to be on your show. The sculpture is 7 metres in diameter and it's all made out of NASA imagery. So it allows the public to get up close to the moon for the first time and see all the craters and the valleys and the mountain in perfect detail. Every centimetre on this sculpture, it's a giant sphere suspended in the nave of the cathedral. So this giant sphere, every centimetre represents about 5 kilometres on the moon's surface. So it's this beautiful artwork, it's internally illuminated. And then it also comes with a surround sound composition that helps kind of connect the sculpture with the surrounding architecture. So yeah, it's very beautiful.
Now, what was the inspiration for creating this? You are an artist who likes to create things that the public can experience in that kind of very visceral way.
Yeah, no, well, I'm based in Bristol. And here we've got, I think, Europe's second highest tidal range. And about 20 years ago, I had this idea to create a sculpture of the moon. And it was sort of inspired by cycling over the river every day and noticing this huge tidal variation. And of course, it's the moon that makes that happen. So I had this idea to create my own moon. But back then, the data wasn't available and the printing technology hadn't been invented. So it took about sort of 10 years for the idea to sort of simmer away, waiting for the opportunity for this sculpture to be born. And it took about 6 months to make. The first moon I made was actually helium filled and it popped live on BBC television. It was a complete disaster. So I had to sort of redesign it.
The whole moon popped.
It's been quite successful. Sorry?
The entire moon popped.
Yeah. It was designed to go outside. It went into a hot air balloon fiesta, but it was far too windy and it was all a bit of a disaster. It's the nature of doing new things a lot of the time is you have to be willing to fail, to take risks and learn from those failures when things go wrong and then get back on your horse and give it another go.
And when you say you made it, Luke, how do you go about making it? Do you find the right people? You know the right people, I guess, who can make this?
Yeah, so I'm lucky enough to live just around the corner from a hot air balloon manufacturing company. So I popped into them and I had conversations. And I design all the details, but they do the actual fabrication. But a lot of the artwork I make is often created in collaboration with people, whether that's composers or glass blowers or engineers. And often, yes, it's best if I can to work with experts who make things rather than try and have a go at this stuff myself. But I often build all the prototypes and do all the testing. But the actual final design is made by someone else.
Now, from space exploration, we feel we have an idea of what the moon's surface is like. But I mean, mainly it's from television imagery taken by astronauts or by remote cameras. But how did you go about creating it and mapping it to such a specification?
So NASA have sent satellites right around the surface of the moon. So they've got all the imagery. And the great thing about NASA is they allow the public to use their imagery. So I got the imagery from NASA. And of course, the moon that we see in the sky only faces one way. We only get to see the front side of the moon. So this artwork allows the public to go all the way around the back and see the far side or the dark side of the moon for the first time as well. So that's really quite exciting for lots of people. In fact, a little girl came up to me at one of the exhibitions and she said, "Will you put the moon back afterwards?" So she thought I'd stolen the real moon. I thought that was rather cute.
Now, there is, as you said, a musical piece, that an immersive musical piece, and we're going to play a clip from that now.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
Music from Museum of the Moon, composed by Dan Jones, and that included clips, of course, of John F. Kennedy's speeches where he was taking on the big adventure of the moon, moon landing. And we're talking to Luke Durham, who is the creator of Museum of the Moon. As well as this wonderful dome recreating the moon for people in St. Canice's Cathedral, there's other events happening underneath the dome that people can experience and get more information and get more involved.
Yeah, that's right. So this, it is an installation for people to enjoy, but the Museum of the Moon also acts as a venue. So there's a whole series of events taking place underneath the moon over the 3 week period that it's in the cathedral. So there's theatre events and like drawing classes, musical performances. There's even having a special meal underneath the moon as well, and storytelling. So yeah, lots of different sort of ticketed events taking place. And that will be taking place both in the daytime and at night. So it should be quite an unusual and wonderful opportunity for people to kind of have their close encounter with the moon for the first time.
Did you have any surprises when you started having these close encounters with the moon?
Yeah, I did. The first time I saw this artwork, I was slightly, shocked actually by the beauty of it. I've been making artwork for about 28 years now, and some artworks I create are okay. And then just occasionally, once every 10 years, I come up with something that even surprises myself. There's this lovely illusion of texture that people get when they look at the moon, the artwork I've created. So even though the sculpture is flat, there's this illusion of texture. So people often ask me, you know, if the moon's made of concrete or fiberglass or something like that. So that was really nice. It was very special. Someone asked me once, how did you get the moon into the cathedral? And I joked online that it took us six months to take all the stained glass windows out. But of course, I was joking, you know, but all the press turned up, sort of angry neighbours thinking we'd taken all the stained glass windows. But actually, the moon packs down into quite a small box and allows me to transport it all around the world. So this Museum of the Moon has been to, maybe 30 different countries all around the world, because the moon has great significance in every culture around the world. If we take the moon to America, people obviously over there think about the Apollo moon missions. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we take it to China, they celebrate the moon as a part of the mid-autumn festival. Last year, I took the moon to Kerala in India, and 100,000 people turned up on one night to come and see the moon. It was completely crazy. And it's because the moon has massive significance in Hindu culture. So the moon has different significance in culture and religions all around the world. So it'll be really interesting to see, what people make of it in Kilkenny.
Indeed it will. And is it fragile?
It's not too bad. It's actually designed to go indoors, but also outside as well. So we've suspended it over lakes and over rivers. We've taken it to Toronto and put it out in the ice and snow. It is quite durable, really. It was electrocuted once. It got struck by lightning, and that wasn't very good for it. But generally, it's been all right. We did take it to America once. And it came back with small holes in it. I think someone decided to try and shoot the moon, expecting it to sort of blow up dramatically, like a something out of Hollywood. But of course, this moon artwork is air-filled, and so the bullet would have passed through the membrane of one side of the moon and popped out the other without too much fuss. But that's America for you. Hey?
All right, but presumably you're not wanting any of that kind of activity down in St. Thomas's. The people of Kilkenny, or maybe a slitter and a hurley, they might come in to the St. Canice's. I hope none of that happens. I won't be giving them bad ideas.
We took the moon to France, and we put deck chairs out underneath it in a nice row. And within about 20 minutes, all those deck chairs have been put into pairs. And there were lots of couples sitting on these deck chairs, holding hands, having romantic moments underneath the moon. So, it'll be interesting to see what the response is in Kilkenny. I'm sure it'll be rather sedate.
Well, I hope that something like that happens. That would be lovely. Luke Jerram, thank you so much. Luke's installation, Museum of the Moon, will be in St. Canice's Cathedral in Kilkenny for 3 weeks from March the 10th. For full details of the exhibition and a full lineup of events, go to stcanicescathedral.ie.